I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Sarah Rushing, Associate Professor of Political Science at Montana State University. We're discussing her 2021 book, The Virtues of Vulnerability, Humility, Autonomy, and Citizen Subjectivity, from Oxford University Press. Rushing works on the history of political thought, feminist theory, democratic theory, and the relationship between ethics and politics, and is the author of many articles on these topics. She's also co-president of the Association for Political Theory. Let me say, first of all, Sarah Rushing, thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you today.
Sarah, I love this book. It was really great analysis of both the theoretical and conceptual approaches to autonomy and how to reform the notions of autonomy in terms of humility, which I liked bringing those concepts together, as well as your application to several different domains of life, from birth all the way to death and to PTSD. It's a really wide-ranging discussion, so thanks for it. Let me ask, just first of all, what motivated you to write the book in the first place?
Yeah, well, as you've noted, it is a wide-ranging discussion. And so there are a number of threads that kind of ultimately wove together into this book, and different threads had different kind of origins. So I think big picture, what gave me the kind of main set of questions was sort of my own experience being pregnant and giving birth and kind of navigating the maternal health system process and what that looked like and what, you know, how rapidly I kind of became subjected to the good pregnant patient and had to sort of learn in real time what I wanted, what things meant, how to engage with medical authorities, where to resist things that didn't feel right to me. And, you know, so that experience was really kind of a, like a trial by, you know, baptism by fire. I was just like learning so much in real time, and the stakes felt pretty high in terms of like, I'm going to have to go through this thing and no one can do it for me. And so I really want to know what I'm doing. And I don't know how I'm going to know that or, you know, what information to trust. So that just bodily experience motivated kind of the crux of the book, the body chapters that really kind of look at the in extreme detail, kind of how do we go through these things. The humility thread kind of came out around the same time when I was had just started my tenure track job at Montana State University. And, you know, it's funny how much happenstance goes into our intellectual history. So my in-laws in Connecticut said, well, now that you have a job at Montana State University, does that make it easier to get a different job in Connecticut? I said, oh, no. And I realized they were just really disappointed because my job had basically meant that their wonderful son was not going to be living, you know, particularly close to them. And around this same time, I was walking down the hall of my building on campus, and I saw a flyer for a National Endowment for the Humanities summer seminar at Wesleyan University, which is about half an hour from where they live. And I thought, that would be great. You know, we go to Connecticut for the whole summer. They would forgive me for getting a job in Montana. They would be, you know, on hand to help with our one-year-old daughter. And this seminar looks really great. And the seminar was on virtue ethics and Confucianism. And I thought, well, I don't know anything about Confucianism. And I know a little bit about virtue ethics, but I love bringing traditions together. That's kind of what, you know, makes me most excited intellectually, is weaving different intellectual traditions together into conversation. So I applied to this seminar. And I got into it. I was the only political theorist with 15 philosophers. And it was great. And it was, you know, it was a really, I'm not even sure if NEH is funding these kinds of seminars anymore, but it was 6 weeks of just immersive reading and discussion. And it really led me to think about humility in the Confucian tradition and how it might be generative to go to a tradition that was largely unfamiliar to most people I would be talking to and had been largely unfamiliar to me, to kind of recuperate a concept that's really important, but that we don't have, in my account, great resources for in, you know, Western thought. So that those kind of threads came together and ultimately wove into what the book is. And then the last chapter was on exit. And that really was kind of an idea I came to late in writing the book, but really motivated me to think about what my next project will be, because it's basically all loose threads. And so as you said, there's many layers to the book. I think sometimes if I'd been more strategic, it would have been a couple different books. But I do think it's like a journey I really do want to take readers through to think about how to transform our thinking about the place of the body in politics.
Yeah, I mean, this book is a great example of, I think, political theory writ large. So I think you're an exemplar of political theory in this way. This is what I think political theory does distinctively and distinctively well, which is to sort of synthesize a number of different perspectives and approaches to phenomena. So maybe I'll have to have you back. I did, you know, but it's now a couple of years ago, what is political theory episode? You know, nobody could come up with an answer to what it is, which I think is telling.
Yeah.
Terms of because the sort of, it's difficult to pin down something that has a sort of hands in many different cookie jars, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, all right. So this is good. You gotta keep your book in mind as an exemplar for the next discussion when that comes up. So I wanted to ask, I mean, just first of all, just sort of set the stage in terms of the overall problem that motivates the book. You know, a certain notion that you identify about a liberal or neoliberal conception of choice and control, or neoliberal conception of autonomy, mm-hmm. that brings along with it a certain set of practical theoretical problems in your view. And I thought maybe you could sort of walk us through what you see to be, you know, that certain conception of choice and control, which is probably going to be pretty familiar to listeners, a certain conception of autonomy as a kind of sovereign control and consent to choice with regard to the world, a certain conception of the liberal self. And then it sort of walks through, you know, what the limitations of that are on your view that sort of get this project started.
Yeah, well, so I think you started to talk about it, this idea of the sort of, you know, entrepreneurial, personal, responsible, you know, autonomous choice maker, the kind of consumer model that has been transplanted into so many domains of our lives, where we're sort of picking off a menu of things and making good choices is how we have control and agency. And, you know, I think that we see that in, you know, at least the discourse of higher education. You know, my students are often hailed as, you know, consumer students who should make good choices about the, you know, educational product they're, buying on a market. You know, all that economic idiom really just permeates everywhere. But we see that in politics, right? And then we really see it in healthcare, where again, we're hailed as sort of the consumer patient, and good choice making is our route to sort of a satisfactory outcome. And so there's that whole sense that you know, freedom is narrowed down very, very quickly to just picking off the menu well. And that for many people that it doesn't feel like a particularly authentic form of autonomy. And yet it's so pervasive that when I give talks and I sort of draw attention to all the ways this idea of being a choice maker bombards us in daily life, you see people sort of like a light bulb going on in their head, like, oh gosh, I really wasn't even aware of how often I'm being told that that's what I am and that that's how I'm free. And then also as a teacher, you know, often when I think I've got something figured out in my own head, I go and teach my students and then they show me all the ways in which I, you know, still haven't made it totally clear. But they often ask me, like, what's the difference between self-determination, autonomy, freedom, and liberty? And I'm like, well, you know, it kind of depends who you ask. And there's no one answer. But there are ways that some of those concepts have different intellectual histories that might open up different possibilities. And others have intellectual histories that might be, you know, might be subject to recuperation and maybe not so much so. So, you know, I had heard someone give a talk maybe 6 years ago when I was sort of really getting into this project about autonomy. I kept thinking, why autonomy? Why autonomy? Why are you going back to Kant and wanting to talk about autonomy again? Like, why don't we try to work with this concept of freedom or self-determination or some of the ideas that come out of feminist theory that are much richer and more complex? But in the process of trying to, you know, think this through for myself, I dove into the feminist relational autonomy literature. And I thought, oh, okay, I actually think this does a great job of pulling in threads of freedom and self-determination and autonomy as a really richly supported condition, not just this kind of liberal non-interference conception that we tend to kind of at least distill autonomy down to in political theory, or many people do. So that's kind of where I wanted to go with that idea, is to work with it, but make it richer. Mm-hmm.
I didn't mean to interrupt. I mean, I found this helpful because in a certain way, it seemed to me you were sort of targeting two different elements or two different limitations of the, you know, say liberal notion of autonomy. I mean, one is, I think, what you just alluded to there, which is the way in which, you know, kind of non-interference view of autonomy misses the many ways in which individual choice is thoroughly constrained by social circumstances that we have no control over. And so it limits our control, and hence a kind of positive conception of liberty sort of can overcome that. But I also found fascinating the way in which, you know, a lot of your book is about the ways in which, you know, I don't know, call it fortuna or chance or, you know, natural sort of occurrences that are related to birth and death here and are lodged in the body represent important limitations on choice. And so, yeah, I mean, I thought maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, the body and how that plays into your theory, what are the consequences of liberal conception of autonomy sort of overlooking or abstracting from the body?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in the liberal tradition, and in certain ways in the classical Greek tradition, like the mind, rationality is the key to a well-ordered life. And, you know, when I teach, I show my students, you know, what does Plato's tripartite soul look like? Like, the brain is the big part in my kind of silly mock-up of it, and the heart and the stomach are to be subordinate to the brain. And that's a well-ordered life, right? That's kind of an ethically well-ordered soul. And similar in the liberal tradition, you know, I have this other slide I show them, it's, you know, reason plus freedom equals progress. And again, it's like rationality paired with liberty will lead us to advance. And so, so that idea of rationality that I think in, you know, neoliberal capitalist logic becomes choice making, you know, good choice, making good choices becomes the route to freedom. And then in the American context, which is always, you know, kind of the Protestant capitalist context, what that really means is like, there, if you made good choices, then you had as much control as you could out over the outcome, and then you're not to blame. So really that conception of responsibility is always lurking there, and kind of almost in an accountability or in a liability sense. So when you get into the medical context, liability and accountability have a whole different meaning, right? And so there is this idea that if we just really manage everything, right, if this sort of hyper managerial ethos that permeates the modern hospital, if we just manage everything right, it'll go right, you know, and no one will be sued, essentially, right? Or, you know, the patient won't leave and think, what just happened, right? I don't know what just happened. You know, I checked all the boxes. I signed the informed consent forms. I did my research. I followed the directions. I tried to have some agency, and I have no idea what just happened, which, you know, just anecdotally is an experience I hear a lot of people recall when they come out of an intense medical experience, whether that's giving birth, whether that's helping a loved one navigate the process of death and dying, whether it's navigating their own cancer diagnosis, right? What have you. Some people come out and think, well, that was horrible, but it went as great, you know, as great as it could. But a lot of people come out and think, I'm so confused about what happened there. And, you know, it's not just because they were a bad choice maker. It's because our bodies often have their own plans. So in the context of the body, that whole concept of choice really just becomes exposed for the very precarious promise that it is. And for me, I think, you know, that's something we're all going to have to face at some point, whether we want to or not. And so it's a really rich place to think through this, you know, human experience, but also how some of our conceptual apparatus may not serve us very well at these crucial moments in our lives.
Yeah, when your choices are, I think your examples are really well chosen, because it's, you know, the kind of analysis, the sort of Foucauldian inspired analysis that you're doing, it really is. I mean, Foucault chooses, you know, punishment and sexualities, ways in which, you know, the body intersects very strongly with the systems of modern control. And I think that you extending this to the
medical industrial complex, I guess, in birth and death and dying is and PTSD, soldiers coming home, is really, you know, sort of well chosen. And I certainly want to talk about those. I have young kids too. So, I, you know, my wife and I went through the similar process in terms of birth. So it'd be good to talk about that. But, you know, just in terms of finish up the conception of autonomy here, I mean, I thought maybe you could maybe say a little bit about, I mean, kind of what liberalism you had in mind in a certain way. I guess that, you know, because I'm currently working on Kant, so I have Kantian autonomy in mind, which in a way, I mean, I guess the first point to make is the notion of autonomy I think you're using is not Kantian in the sense that it's about, you know, Kant would never recognize mere choice as you know, representation or exemplification of autonomy. This is, you know, autonomy is a kind of, you know, acting based on the moral law, which is in some sense opposite of just making mere choice. But so do you have in mind, I mean, mainly kind of, you know, contemporary neoliberal forms of autonomy, or you would sort of more want to make more ambitious claim about sort of liberalism generally?
No, it's interesting because, you know, I didn't go like back deeply into the liberal tradition to map out and like kind of prove that this is the conception. I kind of took my point of departure from feminist theories, critique, and then resuscitation of, you know, autonomy as relational autonomy. And it's interesting because in the feminist, you know, texts and debates about autonomy, particularly the, you know, key texts, the relational autonomy, the reader, and then the books that kind of flowed from that and others in that gambit, there, some of the feminist theorists debate like, well, who actually says this? Well, that's not what, you know, Kant never really said that. And I think that's probably true, right? It's easy to sort of caricature, you know, generously or ungenerously a certain tradition of thought and not go back and show like, okay, here's where that really gets established. But I also think it's not invalid to say, you know, whether that's precisely what Kant or others in that tradition of thinking about sort of autonomy as a kind of attaching to humans per se in this metaphysical sense, you know, this is how we've inherited it. So this is how it gets bandied about, or culturally, this is how it's manifest. And so I didn't take that debate up myself necessarily, because I didn't feel like I needed to prove the existence of it so I could disprove it. But I really wanted to say, like, there is a way. It's, I mean, you know, I think we see that ethos, whether we see the actual conception, in Rawls really strongly, right? Where it's like, you know, I'm gonna thicken this out later. I'm gonna flesh this out. I'm gonna make it richer, more complex later. But, you know, does he? but you know, my point was really to say, I don't necessarily need to go back and think about whether that tradition has more to it than it, you know, I'm saying. I really think this conception of relational autonomy does what needs to be done. And it does it by looking to the body and by looking to the conditions really richly under which we can strive for or aspire for autonomous engagement with our own lives. And really to not think of it as a status or an accomplishment, but more like an ongoing project. So I think you're right. If you said what some of those feminist theorists said to me, well, who really says that? I think the answer might be like, well, nobody in that really kind of blunt force way necessarily. But I do think that that's how we've sort of inherited it. It's a very disembodied, it's very masculine, it's very rational conception. It's a very sort of metaphysical conception of sort of like generic humans, you know, not something you come into the world and struggle for with others. And some have a better chance of attaining, you know, moments of it than others because of things like their race, class, gender, ability. That's just not part of, you know, I think the 20th century canon of talking about autonomy. In my sense, at least, it's pretty disembodied.
Yeah, and that's, I found your discussion of feminist relational autonomy very useful. I mean, sorry, because like I don't know this tradition all that well. I don't know if you want to say just a little bit more, just in terms of, you know, what you draw from. I mean, you already did sort of start to talk about this, that it's, I found your language just now helpful in terms of that it's not a status, that it's a sign, nor is it an achievement, which is interesting, but it's a sort of processual, sort of ongoing, always on the way towards autonomy. Does that have it right?
Yeah, absolutely. And then in different contexts and in under different conditions, we're going to experience it differently. So, you know, there might be a domain in which I feel like a really effective agent and I have, you know, a rich network of relations and conditions that have built up this competency within me to make what feel like genuinely self-determining choices that another person might regard as also genuinely self-determined, right? And then I might find myself in another domain where I think, I'm kind of floundering here, you know? I mean, I talk in the book about when I was pregnant with my daughter at 35 and I went, because I was a geriatric, you know, an elderly mother. And so I went to a perinatologist to decide if I was going to get an amniocentesis. And I, you know, I obviously really did not want to do that because if you know anything about an amniocentesis, it involves, you know, having a giant needle thrust into your abdomen, into your amniotic sac with a risk of miscarriage. Now, you know, not so many years later, there are many better options. But when I was pregnant 13 years ago, that was the option. And so I was trying to decide, you know, how do I decide whether to do this? I don't feel like I have any competency here. I don't know. I don't have the perspective that I don't have the experience, right? And so I was really asking this perinatologist, like, well, okay, you know my, you know, my health, you know my age, you know my preferences. What would you do if you were me? And he said, you know, I can't tell you. And he gave me lots of statistics about it. And I looked at him and I thought, well, if I was your daughter and you were a perinatologist, what would you tell her to do? And he laughed. He said, like, I can't really tell you. And I just thought, like, I need more from this person to feel genuinely autonomous. And I think he thinks he's respecting my autonomy by not interfering in my choice making. But in fact, I feel really ill-equipped to feel self-determining right now. I feel like I'm kind of grasping in the dark. And I ultimately decided not to have the test. And he kind of, you know, he didn't wink at me on the way out, but I got the sense that like I'd made a good choice. But it didn't feel like I thought, oh yay, you know, I took good for me. Like it just didn't feel like a really genuinely autonomous engagement. That became kind of the, you know, emotional basis for much of my thinking about the book. Autonomy in the relational autonomy, the feminist relational autonomy sense requires, you know, quite a lot. And non-interference is not really part of the picture, you know, and it's ultimately, you know, the procedural relational autonomy theorists, you know, want to say like a number of conditions have been met. And at that point you make whatever choice and nobody scrutinizes it. The substantive relational autonomy theorists think, okay, a number of conditions have been met and you make your choice. And if it's not a good choice, we still don't have to call it autonomous, right? So there's different levels of, I don't want to say judgment, but you know, analysis that would follow within these two main orientations, procedural and substantive. I'm torn between the two, frankly, myself.
And does the accountability point, I mean, because I'm interested in the relationship between autonomy and accountability, right? Because as you say, initially, like autonomy is the basis for moral accountability. And indeed, this is the sort of, you know, this is a zoom out, is sort of the basis for a meritocratic social system that we have. So is it, how does merit, not meritocracy, but accountability play a role then in that conception?
Well, I think if you think of autonomy as sort of an achievement or a status, right? And you can think about that in different ways, right? Sort of metaphysical, or you could think about it like, okay, when you're 18, you're an adult, and therefore you can make whatever decisions you want for yourself, right? To a point. Then there's a different kind of like regard for the consequences that might follow from bad choices or, you know, from non-autonomous decisions. And I think when you see autonomy more as a project that's broadly supported by other people and by a rich set of conditions, then I think there's a sense of letting people sort of make choices, but also not penalizing them then if the choices don't bear out well for them, right? If their autonomy doesn't go well, right? You maybe sort of see that, you know, it's an ongoing project. So I think, my hope is that you could take autonomy and connect it to a kind of self-determination that did involve making choices for oneself and extract that from the intensive blame society that I think is the form that accountability takes today. Right.
Certainly very individualized. I mean, I was thinking, you know, more of a socialized conception of autonomy, right? If you have a really relational view of autonomy, who's to blame if something goes wrong? Not, you know, you don't want to say like that atomistic person, right? But it's the entire network or social system that's sort of broken down. And so,
right. And of course, if you're a parent, you know, you sort of live this every day in certain regards. Because much as I hate the term make good choices, I hear myself saying it to my kids all the time.
Right? I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
I do. I say, oh, come on, you guys, make good choices. Like, and then I try and step back and think, like, okay, what are all the things that have to go into supporting you and making a good choice? But at the end of the day, I just really want them to do what I want them to do and what I think is the right thing. And, you know, then the flip side of that is when they don't, how much do I say, well, tough luck, or told you so? I mean, obviously you want to say that all the time as a parent. And if you're a decent parent, you try hard not to most of the time. But there is that, you know, real question. Okay, I set you free to give it a go, and you gave it a go, and it didn't go very well. Like, you know, what happens now? I mean, in parenting, you hear all the time this term natural consequences. Well, there's something to natural consequences. There's something to try to sort of, you know, save your children from too much pain so that they, you know, can go on to continue that project of being self-determining. So I think it's, I mean, so many of these ideas I began working with before I was, you know, raising full-fledged humans, I now have to confront all the time. I mean, I wanted to write about humility because I found it to be really challenging personally. And boy, I get a chance to practice it all the time as a parent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's great. So let's talk about humility, because I did identify with that too as a parent. So humility, I mean, it's interesting, you know, concept that you bring into conversation with autonomy, because it, autonomy concept, because it seems in some ways, as you say in the book, that they're in some ways you might conceive them as opposites, right? Which is in the sense that autonomy, at least it's conceived in the liberal way that we've been talking about, is about sovereign self-control and self-mastery. And humility is in some ways the opposite, which is sort of letting oneself go, being submissive or subordinate. So, but you want to argue that they're not opposites, they don't balance one another, but in some ways they're co-constitutive, in the sense that, you know, like autonomy is itself should be conceived of through humility. I think that discussion of feminist relational autonomy, I think we just had, is helpful to see where you're going there. But so in any case, maybe you could say a little bit about humility and, you know, how it plays a role here in your theory.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I put it in the book is that humility needs autonomy and autonomy needs humility. You know, they sort of they go hand in hand for both to be kind of beneficial dispositions, right? And it's not that they're sort of different ends of a pendulum swing where one is this, you know, quest for glorious self-determination and the other is, you know, abject failure to achieve that, right? It's more that sort of to strive to be autonomous, you need to understand what a precarious wager it can be in life. And then when you do achieve, you know, what feels like kind of autonomous self-trust, self-definition, self-direction in life, that you recognize it for how precarious it is and how supported and how relational. And then when you fail, you know, again, this goes back to this idea of sort of blame culture. In a blame culture, when you fail, it's just humiliating. But I wanted to sort of uncouple humility from humiliation and say that, you know, humility kind of, I think, in its most vitalizing form is what allows us to look at ourselves in our human, all too human moments and laugh with ourselves, you know, to have that humor, to be humble, to think, well, you know, so it goes. And to see that that's kind of what happens when you strive to be a free person, right? You fall on your face sometimes and that's okay. That's what it means to be human. I mean, that's, you know, really, I think big picture, what I wanted to get in this book is like, you know, how we think about what it means to be human can be really messy and a struggle. And it has moments of beauty and connectedness and empowerment, and it has all the other moments too. And we can't sort of set those moments aside as, you know, anomalies, you know, and focus on the kind of the nice moments of empowered freedom and self-determination as the norm. They're not the norm. Right? It's all a wager, right? And then again, you know, to kind of come up with this conception, which in the book I call humility-informed relational autonomy, right? A kind of cluster concept, right? Where they're not necessarily two sides of a coin, but they're kind of part and parcel with each other. And I short-term this at the end of the book as HERA, And I thought this little idea that I might write a small book about the lost goddess of nevertheless persisting, right? Hera, the anti-hero. And there's part of me that's like kind of joking. And part of me is like, yeah, that's really interesting. And so I could say more about that if you want down the road, because it's something I'm toying with. But the concept of humility, I needed to go to kind of get to humility-informed relational autonomy was obviously not the one we've inherited in Western thought, primarily from Christianity, but this other kind of reconstructed concept of humility that I found in the Analects of Confucius.
Yeah, and I thought you could say about that, because I found this fascinating that, I mean, one of the worries, obviously, that one might have with inheriting humility is that it's the sort of the anti-political, right. Virtue and the Christian tradition mm-hmm. that it's sort of submissive. And so it might be at odds with the kind of citizenship approach that you want to take. But yeah, then you turn to Confucius, so maybe you could say, so how does the Confucian notion of humility sort of differ from or compare and contrast with the Christian approach?
Yeah, well, so like I mentioned before, I first, encountered Confucius in this seminar on virtue ethics and Confucianism. So really looking at kind of Aristotle and Confucius as both virtue ethicists, and looking at, how we read Aristotle through the lens of Confucian virtue ethics and vice versa, and parse out what their kind of ethical sets are, and the worlds that they lived in and how these kind of played out. And there are a lot of overlaps, and there are some, really serious differences too. In the Analects, there isn't actually a word for humility. There's no like distinct attention to humility. In Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, there is some attention to humility, but it's not in a beneficial way. It's not one of the virtues that the Greeks championed. It was considered sort of having false knowledge of yourself or not knowing when you were good at something, right? So it wasn't a virtue. It wasn't exactly a vice. It was just kind of not, proper pride was what Aristotle was arguing for. So in the Analects, what I really like about it is similarly to the ethics is that the ethics and politics are intertwined. So, you can read the Analects and you're saying, yeah, this is a moral theory and it's a political theory, the same way you might read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. There's not a distinction there. And I think that's a really great starting point. For me, I think politics and ethics run together all the time and they're not separate spheres. And if we treat them that way, we miss a lot. So I liked that about the Analects. And then I really liked that what I saw is this kind of foundational, this root conception of humility that ran across the text, that it came about through very set practices, right? So it wasn't just something you sort of were or weren't, but you could practice cultivating the disposition of humility through learning and reflecting when you were with a group of other people, through properly assessing yourself, and through understanding the role of fate in our lives as a kind of a limiting factor on our freedom. And I really liked the ways in which I saw Confucius teaching about this disposition was through often political examples, right? So if the king that you don't like sends a liaison to your house to talk to you and you want to rebuff that king, right? The proper way to do it with humility is you don't go down and say, get out of here, I'm not talking to your king, but you just have your person say, well, I'm sorry that he's not home. And then as soon as the liaison walks away, you start singing in the backyard. that's so specific, right? Which is really what's the joy of reading the Analects. I mean, it's a very old text. So some of the examples are really totally, foreign to us, but it's really specific. And so I liked that as a way of re-articulating a concept of humility in a political context linked to conception of fate and then partnering it with feminist relational autonomy.
Yeah, good. And I mean, maybe just to finish off this discussion of the, before we turn to the concrete examples on the sort of theory side of things, just to sort of connect the ethics and the politics, because I mean, this is, really one of your main projects here is to see how this conception of relational autonomy with humility can sort of galvanize a new conception of citizenship effect that it has beneficial consequences, just to put in those terms, for right. Developing a more robust kind of citizenship. And so maybe you could just draw that out for us.
Yeah, I think this has been a project of mine for a long time in a way that I realize more clearly in writing the book. But this idea that there are all these ways in which we're always preparing for politics. You know, I think many people don't think about their daily lives as preparing them for politics, but I really do. I mean, that's one of the things I love about political theory is you can think of the political really expansively, and you can think about political learning really expansively. So, you know, some political learning is really obvious, like studying for the citizenship exam. But a lot of political learning happens in places we don't necessarily think of it as happening. So for me, it's the hospital, the clinic, right? Where I think there's all this learning that goes on as a patient that's very political. So I have this idea that in that political learning, something's happening to our subjectivity. And I want to characterize it as the emergence of a kind of citizen subjectivity. And again, I don't care about like legal citizenship. More citizenship is a set of dispositions towards being engaged with the community and self directing our lives, right? So the citizen subjectivity is this kind of like emergent consciousness in a sort that comes about when we find ourselves kind of in a politicized or political environment, and we kind of put our demand to be self-determining to work. But I think in all these other places in our lives, we are preparing for politics. And I think that is the sort of self-cultivation aspect that we tend to treat as ethics, and not, I think, traditionally link that closely to then who are we now that find ourselves in this political moment, right? The who we are informs whether we even see the political moment in front of us, whether we step into it, and then how we engage once we're there. So I really, that's, I think, really the feminist theorist in me who takes the idea of consciousness raising really seriously, and wants to say that there are all these ways in our day-to-day lives that our consciousness is awakening, and that we're preparing, for better or for worse. Because sometimes what I say, you know, when people navigate the hospital system, they have terrible, totally immobilizing experiences. And, you know, their response is to be like, I'm totally ineffective and can't navigate information and make choices, right? So really desubjugating experience. But under better conditions, my hope is that people have an awakened citizen subjectivity that, you know, kind of is a light bulb that goes on and says, aha, I get this. Now I'm seeing this, you know, and now I'm wanting to engage here differently. And I'm getting a sense of how this system works, which might not be what the official marketing was telling me. So the citizen subjectivity and the preparing to find ourselves in those moments that then goes well beyond the clinic or higher education or the prison system or whatever, these, you know, immersive institutional contexts where we learn a lot that we're not necessarily knowing we're learning.
Yeah, I found this, you know, it was a sort of unexpected argument, but I liked it a lot because in effect, you know, what you're saying is something, it's unexpected in the sense that, you know, you might expect that this kind of stronger notion of self-mastery, liberal notion of autonomy would itself be good training ground for citizenship, right? Kind of liberal democratic citizenship, but in effect, it's not. It's that immobilizing, disempowering form, because if you conceive of autonomy in these strict self-mastery terms, and then you're subject to all these kinds of experiences where you're not, where you're in effect not in control of your fate, it can be, as you say, disempowering. But if you think about autonomy in the way that you do, which is, it's not expected that it would lead to form of citizenship because it's based on kind of humility and autonomy, but it's this sort of, you know, an openness to others and a collaborative approach. I found it also very useful in the sense that you don't talk about this in the book, but I, you know, thinking about today's political climate in America and how polarized American politics is, I couldn't help but think, well, I mean, this is an effect of a certain kind of view of autonomy and self-mastery. You know, if we had a little dose of Sarah Rushing and, you know, humility, yeah, humility inspired autonomy, we might be a little bit more open and forgiving to one another. I don't know if you had any, you know, if that occurred to you at all, or if that...
Yes. You know. No, it has occurred to me a lot this past year. You know, I've been thinking about and writing a little bit about the idea of the body politic infected with a virus, right? So we are literally a body politic infected with a virus, and sort of think about like what happens when the body politic is at odds? How are all the ways we might kind of take, you know, Hobbes' project where he uses all these bodily metaphors for thinking about politics, right? The person who has another person growing out of their side, or, you know, lupus, or he has all these, you know, at the end of book two of Leviathan, has all these really like kind of gruesome health examples as ways of kind of scaring us into comporting ourselves properly, right? As a sovereign society. And I think that's such an interesting, I love that part of Hobbes. I mean, it's where Hobbes gets really kind of like, all right, well, if I haven't persuaded you over the last couple hundred pages, I'm going to really stick it to you now with a discussion of worms and lumps and all these other things. But I was thinking, okay, what disease would characterize our body politic today? And, you know, it's like, maybe it's an autoimmune disorder. Like we're killing each other from within, right? The body is attacking itself. And how do we think about these political dispositions that I, you know, just spent a whole bunch of time thinking about as coming to bear in this moment? Because part of what I am suggesting is, you know, we are vulnerable and we are interdependent. And the things that help us navigate that productively are humility-informed relational autonomy and a certain citizen subjectivity. And what that means is recognizing that we don't get to say once and for all, here's how it's going to go. The nature of politics is that it's collaborative, it's collective self-determination. And really in the history of America, there hasn't been a self that's determining itself. So it's struggle, it's conflict, fine. You know, we don't have to seek harmony, but there is kind of a point at which we have to recognize we're in this together. So how's it going to go down? And, you know, compromise has a notoriously bad reputation in politics. Nobody likes when their person compromises, right? Nobody likes when their representative compromises or their president compromises. And yet there is something to like, how are we gonna kind of go forward together as one body politic after this year of COVID has just really just plainly shown how divided the body is, which, you know, we've known before, but now the stakes for, you know, 500,000 people dead. So there's part of me that thinks like, okay, I just written this whole book that's kind of given me some guidance about how to think about being in politics today. And I'm like, ugh, but it sounds hard and I don't want to do it. I just want everyone to agree with me and start behaving themselves, right? It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's great. So I thought we could talk about the, you know, your concrete examples here. I mean, starting with birth, mm-hmm. and the kind of medicalization of childbirth that you talk about in the book, and the sort of practical problems that are associated with it, how it's rooted in those practical problems are rooted in a certain conception of mm-hmm. liberal autonomy, and then maybe how, you know, we can sort of address those problems by reforming, by turning towards a more relational view of autonomy. We've already been sort of talking about the childbirth example a couple of times. So, maybe you could say a little bit about how you might think about this, you know, relational form of autonomy may kind of positively address some of the problems that you see in the around childbirth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so. You know, I've had a couple friends who are doctors read my book and they say, well, here are all the reasons we can't, you know, make the kinds of changes you're asking for, you know, the kind of change that would really change the way we, you know, support childbirth in the United States. And so much of what they point to is not medical, you know, it's the insurance and the legal and the policy framework within which they're operating. And I think, you know, anyone who's sort of spent any time thinking about the American healthcare system probably knows some of that, right? And so there is a point where I think, okay, I'm actually asking for like an overhaul, not a tweak. But I do think, you know, like in my own town, I've watched our hospital. We won one, you know, we're a 50,000 person town. We're starting to grow really rapidly in Bozeman, Montana. We have one hospital. We'll probably have a second in the next couple of years, but you know, it's the place you go. And yet, you know, they have made some changes. You know, they sort of have a monopoly, but they've also made some changes, and they've made some of those changes at the pressure of doctors who've said, we can't practice well this way, you know? And so the risk is you'll get sued for medical malpractice, but really we didn't go into medicine to churn people through. And so some pressure from doctors to say, here are some procedures, like at our hospital until a few years ago, they wouldn't allow you to do a VBAC, which is a vaginal birth after cesarean. So if you'd had a C-section, you pretty much had to have another. That's not the best practice around the country, but it was kind of a standard kind of defensive mechanism in many hospitals. And our hospital changed that. And many women say, I don't want to have another C-section if I don't have to. It's a major abdominal surgery and it has a very long, slow healing process, which is not what you necessarily want when you've got a newborn. But the, you know, the consumer pressure was part of it, but really the doctor pressure was part of it. So I'm confident there are some changes that could happen. And part of my confidence, what gives me confidence when the doctors are pressing for it is that they're saying, we really want to engage with patients in this different way, this much richer, much more meaningful way that takes a lot more time, but the insurance system doesn't really allow us, and the legal and policy framework makes it very hard. But you know, I think it's interesting from my perspective. When I started writing this book, I had a little bit of an opinion about how people should birth. And at this point now, you know, my oldest kid is nine, and my youngest kid is nine. I've sort of let that go. I'm like, obviously, as a, you know, feminist theory saying, do whatever feels right to you. If you want to schedule a C-section in advance, go for it. If you want to have an unassisted home birth and you know what you're doing and you have things in place to help you, sure, go for it. But really what I want, what I still feel very opinionated about is so many women go into their first birth and with their partners having no idea how it's going to go. And that to me is so shocking. And that is also the case, you know, with death and dying and with many veterans. You know, we have been churning out veterans with severe PTSD among many other injuries in the last 15 years. And many of them come back to the US with no idea how to navigate the mental health system, right? And so part of my hope in this book by going into such detail in these chapters and say, here are all the things about how this works, right? Like, here are the ways you can be a compliant patient. When I was pregnant with my daughter, my first child, I remember being told when you enter the hospital, you will get an IV, a port put in case you need a C-section so we can, you know, get everything going in you fast. And I was like, well, do I have to have that? And they said, yeah. And I was like, okay. Which of course I did not have to have that, but I thought, okay, well, they told me that. So when I remember walking in, you know, 6 hours into labor, completely kind of out of it and just sticking my arm out to the guy standing there with the IV thing and being a very compliant, you know, patient. And that was my form of autonomy. I was like, I am going to do all the work here for you because I know how to be a good patient here now. Well, you know, okay, it was fine. You know, whatever, it's IV port, no big deal. But I had no idea really the ramifications of any of that stuff. And so so part of what I want to do in the book is say to people, the way we do these things is not going well. It's really not going well. It's extremely expensive and satisfaction rates are pretty low. And yes, so we could overhaul the whole system. But really what each individual person can do is understand all the things that may or may not happen and think about those in advance. And, you know, the final chapter on exit sort of says, and part of what you might conclude is you don't want to go into the mainstream medical system to do these things. And those are choices you can make too, but no one in the mainstream medical system will encourage you to make those choices.
Right. Yeah. Having a midwife at home and doing a home birth. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. My wife and I considered that, but, you know, ultimately what we went with, and so, you know, I'm in different circumstance in the sense that my wife and I both live in Houston, which is one of the biggest medical center in the world. And, we went to Texas Children's Hospital, which is one of the best, pediatric hospitals, and they have a really great, I mean, from my perspective, although I could, you know, certainly should ask my wife about perspective on this, but they've initiated some reforms, I think, between the birth of my first and my second child. Mm-hmm. And my second is two now, and my oldest is eight. And, but, you know, I mean, so one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, one of the things we did in the case of both births is that we hired a doula, which was interesting experience because the doula was a kind of like mediator between the medical industrial complex and us. And we had like built a nice kind of friendship type relationship. So it was kind of a way in which we could kind of create a Gemeinschaft kind of relationship within the Gesellschaft of the hospital. And so she could kind of, you know, we had to get kind of educated by her and also meet other people who were using the same doula. And so you could kind of build a little community in that. So, I mean, I guess I wanted to ask you in a sense is that, you know, is that a kind of option for thinking about how hospitals might sort of encourage doulas and build that kind of relationship that way?
I mean, it is. It's really interesting because I don't think doctors are big fans of doulas, but I know a lot of
They put up resistance to them, people right?
I mean, I think the doula is a really great example of how to create some real relational autonomy, right? Because it you do build in the conditions, which are time spent with the person and trust built with the person. In the mainstream medical system approach to birthing, those things are, you know, largely absent for most people, right? They're in big OB practices where they see a whole bunch of different, mostly, you know, nurse practitioners and sometimes the OB, and then it's they don't know who will be at their birth. So the relationships aren't there. The trust isn't there. There's just trust in kind of the medical system. But a doula really does build in that relational autonomy, which is someone who might say to you, I know you want this. I know you're saying you want this, but I'm hearing the doctors and I'm hearing the nurses and I'm, you know, have my own experience and I'm, you know, I want to support you in whatever you want, but we might want to think about letting that go, right? And I think that's really hard to hear from someone you don't know if you have a set idea of how you want to birth. But when you have it coming from someone who's a trusted person on your team, so to say, people can hear it a lot better. And so sometimes doulas help you advocate for things you want, but sometimes they also help mediate between you and the medical system to say, I know this is what you came in wanting, but what I think you need to sort of come to grips with right now is that I don't think that's going to work. And that can lead to when you know you have interventions that you didn't necessarily want, feeling like that was the right choice, and that someone who you trusted to help you make that choice, or push you to make that choice, was doing it out of your best interest, not because their shift was ending soon or they didn't want to get sued, right? Which is, I think, where people become suspicious of what motivates doctors to say, "Hey, I think you need a C-section." Also, it's 10:55, and I'm off. My shift ends in 5 minutes, right? So I think there are ways you can build that in. But again, I think that a lot of the doctors I know, they don't like birth plans because they say, okay, these type A women, right, come in with some plan about how it's got to go, and then their body doesn't comply and they think it's our fault. So they don't like birth plans. And they frequently don't really like doulas because it's, again, someone who's slowing the process down by saying, can we ask a few questions? Can we wait for a minute? What are the benefits? What are the risks? What are the alternatives, right? I think good doctors should appreciate that because it really is a partner for them as well. But similarly in hospice, you know, you can hire a patient advocate. So there are things that savvy patients can do to navigate the hospital system with more confidence and with better outcomes. But again, that takes a certain kind of entrepreneurial patient from the beginning. Those aren't systemic changes.
Yeah, because I was going back to thinking about your question earlier about the amniocentesis question from the doctor. And, you know, in some ways, I guess I'm more comfortable with having doctors be more sort of, quote, objective, in the sense that, you know, I'd rather have a doctor, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'd rather have a doctor just give me the facts, mm-hmm. right? And sort of let me make the decision, in the sense that's me being the, my wife and I. But in a sense, it's not just my wife and I, but we would also sort of involve, you know, other close friends, or turn to a doula, and, you know, turn to a kind of, you know, a Gemeinschaft kind of community that you can talk through these things, whereas, you know, leaving the Gesellschaft to do its job, right? It's one of the things, I guess, one of the things I worry about, mm-hmm. Doctors sort of editorializing too much is,
yeah. I mean, I think
about the motivations, right?
What does it mean to be informed, right? I mean, what does it mean to be informed? And for me, I mm-hmm. think there's a certain amount that just, like, facts, right? I mean, obviously there's a lot of us fighting for a world of facts today, and who, you know, are running around all the time, you know, like political theorists are kind of, you know, traditionally critics of sort of epistemic domination. And yet today I'm running around all the time being like, listen to the scientists, listen to the facts, right? I mean, you know, it's kind of a singing a bit of a new tune for me, but, you know, I think facts are really important. I think facts need to be contextualized, and I think facts have meaning beyond sort of statistics themselves. So I think, you know, there are ways to leave someone to ultimately decide, but to say, you know, I know someone who made this choice and here's what went into that decision. And, you know, I think that was the right choice for that person because maybe they had already had a miscarriage and that anxiety was just not worth it for them. Or, you know, and here's, you know, here's what I know other people have done. And so you can, I think, really inform a person in a different way than just giving them the facts. And that really kind of helps them think through the decision-making process, not just churn numbers. So, you know, I think today doctors are often very concerned about, you know, persuading people to make decisions that they won't be happy with. And so they can just be really checked out. And again, you know, that's like, I saw that guy once for like 25 minutes. I had no relationship with him ongoing, you know, after that. But he seemed like a really nice man, which is why I sort of trusted him. You know, I mean, it's all very subjective, right? But I think there are ways of thinking about what does it mean for someone to be genuinely informed. And honestly, it's a much more time-consuming process. And again, that's what doctors aren't, they're not remunerated for that, right? Really, so much of this comes down to, I have 15 minutes in my office with you. And beyond that, I'm not getting paid and I'm behind on my next patient. And so I think there's a real institutional context that combats against that.
Right. And I mean, it's
something
it's
in between not giving anyone any information and telling them what to do.
Right. Well, it's a question about, you know, how doctors are trained to, and what kind of education we give them, because right. I mean, the medical training these days is very technical and very advanced, and understanding the body as a kind of machine, right? And making that body go well, but the education in terms of the, you know, the social, cultural, contextual elements is less there. And I mean, I suppose I just worry about introducing more of that, those kinds of considerations into a medical, maybe I'm wrong about this, but maybe a better option would be just to sort of bolster the doula.
The set
of institutions, and have that role be served by it. And to have, you know, maybe this is the liberal side in me. I like checks and balances. I like I like that doctors can provide one perspective and they can do what they can fight back.
And plenty of doctors are perfectly happy to editorialize, and I would completely reject that. I think for me, you know, it's easier to have someone say, you know, I mean, this is the more common thing people would do in this situation, and here's why they would do it. And for me to be like, I'm not going to do that. But just this, like, you know, blank slate of numbers, I'm like, oh, I don't know. What's it mean? What does it mean for me? And I think that's what it means to really be informed, to know, well, what does this mean for me? And that's, you know, again, that's time consuming. But I agree. I mean, I think one of the things, you know, I'm pretty critical of the way a patient autonomy framework has shaped up under sort of neoliberal capitalist pressures on the medical institution. But I still think patient autonomy is a better kind of default orientation than benevolent paternalism, right? I mean, I think that's been an important transition in healthcare. I just think that patient autonomy, you know, it has to be a certain kind of thinking about autonomy. And it can't just be non-interference, because that doesn't leave people, especially when they're feeling really vulnerable, it doesn't leave them feeling autonomous. And, you know, I think that's the thing. Yeah, go on.
Oh, I was going to talk about death and dying. So was there anything else you wanted to say?
No, I mean, it's a good segue, because what I was just going to say is, and a huge part of that is doctors being trained to be really comfortable engaging with other people's vulnerability. And the death and dying context, I think, is really a bright spot, and not bright in a good way necessarily, but, you know, shining example, glaring example maybe, of where you can be a really competent medical practitioner and really bad at caring for someone in dying if you can't, if you're not comfortable with vulnerability.
Right, right. And I mean, I think it is another good choice, because it's another way in which I think doctors train, they're not trained really to, I think, be equipped to address the sort of emotional and social and cultural meaning around experience and the experiences that accumulate around this. So yeah, so if you could just sort of you know, give us some background on your sense of the kind of main problems that are practical conceptual problems that are surrounds the death and dying in the United States today.
I mean, we spend so much money in the United States on the last couple months and days of people's lives. And so many people who don't want to die in the ICU after long-term illnesses do. It just doesn't, you know, it doesn't make sense. Like, the logic of the way we do death and dying in the United States is, in my opinion, just really saturated with death denial and with a medical institutional context that, that sees death as failure. And so, you know, I think when I was researching that chapter, because I haven't escorted anyone, my parents through death and dying, or my in-laws. I talk at the very beginning of the book about how my brother committed suicide when he was 25, but that was not, you know, there was no process there that I was involved in. And so when I started researching this chapter, I thought, okay, now I'm researching this because I want to know how to do it. I want to know how to help my parents through their, you know, dying times in the best way possible. And it will be new to me. And so I will be in a novel medical institutional context where I'll be trying to figure out what to do in real time again. And I want to know, I want to arm myself as much as I can. And some of the, you know, statistics I encountered in researching that chapter were about sort of, you know, the American use of hospice care, which is really paltry. I mean, the average person in the United States spends about a week or less in hospice care before they die. So those are the ones who go into hospice care, which is not most people anyway. But people who do go into hospice care, which means, you know, they're acknowledging, I'm going to die. I'm going to stop interventionist curative treatment, and I'm going to use palliative care, which alleviates my suffering, but doesn't aim to prolong my life. And I'm going to do it in a way that allows me to be as comfortable and at peace and with my family in my last days. But, you know, if you're going to die in 5 days, that's not very much time, right? You have to be, a doctor has to certify that you're going to die in 6 months or less. That already feels like a very scary thing for people to engage with their doctors on. And doctors are very hesitant to say that you're going to die in 6 months or less. So what ends up happening is people spend very little time in hospice care. And instead, they're in this kind of, you know, combat mode. And, you know, it's one thing if you're a 43-year-old with cancer, combat is the name of the game, right? But if you're an 88-year-old, who's ailing and has said, I don't want to die in the ICU. I just want to go home. And your doctor is saying, there's still one more thing we could try. To me, that is why, under what conditions would that happen? And under what conditions is it happening all the time? So something's really going wrong there. And I think it's institutional, it's legal, it's insurance, it's political, it's spiritual, it's all sorts of things. But I don't want to die that way.
Yeah. Well, I find this interesting in a sense because I'm a little bit puzzled by it because you'd think that the insurance, the capitalist imperatives in insurance companies would push towards more hospice, right? Because I would assume it's cheaper. I mean, it's way more expensive to keep people in an ICU for months and months and months, right? I mean, so why isn't the insurance company leading the charge towards hospice care?
I don't know. And I think a lot depends on how you think of who's deciding what's expensive. So for example, the insurance companies should also be leading the charge for home birth, because home birth has been studied many times now over the last 50 years, you know, primarily in Scandinavian countries in the UK, but also in the United States. And, you know, a trained professional midwife with a healthy, you know, low risk birth, the outcomes are as good or better at home than in the hospital. And it's much cheaper. And yet many insurance companies won't cover it. So it ends up being much more expensive because women just have to pay out of pocket. So it really depends on how you're talking about cheaper and expensive. I mean, I think hospice should be a much cheaper way to tend to someone in the last couple months of their life versus repeat admissions to the hospital and time in the ICU. But I have a friend who's a hospice doctor and said, no, hospice is so much more expensive because of the way the cost structure is put into place. But that's a choice, right? That's a choice that hospitals and the medical system could do differently, but they aren't. And I think probably the malpractice context is a big part of it, right? That if as long as you've done everything you can, you are less likely to get sued, right? So I mean, a huge part of this, which I really do not feel at all legally competent to sort of wade into in the book, is how the medical malpractice system might be reformed to free up kind of a different set of choices, a different risk calculus. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, do you see other countries doing this better? I mean, that's one of the questions I have when thinking about the birth chapter and the death chapter. I mean, you know, you see other countries. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yes, I didn't do like a broad comparative analysis, although I have read a couple books recently that do comparative analysis, particularly like death with dignity laws and stuff. But yes, many countries in Europe in general are doing better, and in Scandinavia and the UK, for sure. And there are places in the United States that are doing much better. So for example, rates of C-section in the United States range from 15% in some hospitals to 65% in others. So 15% is a total outlier. And one of the places, at least, you know, a couple of years ago when I was looking at these statistics, that it sounds on the Navajo Indian Reservation, where you have just a totally different approach to birth. And so you have these like total outlier statistics, but completely possible in the United States, but, you know, not at all what our mainstream medical institutions are doing. In the UK, you have a much greater reliance on birth with a midwife, either at home or just like in a labor and delivery clinic. And so they have lower rates of C-sections, but increasingly C-section rates around the world are approaching ours. And that's just really interesting shift in terms of what that represents. Because in the 70s in the United States, the C-section rates were like way, way, way lower. And it was the introduction of certain, I think, malpractice contacts and interventions, medical interventions, and a different thinking about the risk of birth that has led to them going up by like 30% since the 70s. Women's bodies haven't changed, but the outcomes have.
So. Yeah, one of the things I get worried about in the context of, I think you mentioned a little bit about physician-assisted death, which I guess would play a role in here. One of the things I get worried about with those, with that kind of approach, and I looked a little bit at this for a panel I was on, and one time on physician-assisted death and Scandinavia and elsewhere, is, I mean, I guess one of the worries about that is, I guess the more cynical take on it, when you have situations in which you have, you know, families that are, it's not the ideal family where we have in mind, it's like, everybody loves one another and comes together and decides it's right. Time to move into hospice or have physician assisted death. It's, you know, like, look, grandpa's got to go because it's just, I got to get home to the big game. And like, this is inconvenient for me. So I'm going to pressure the dude to go through physician, you know? So, I mean, is that a worry for you in terms of this, and how does this play in? How does that play into your thought?
I mean, I don't see that personally as a really big genuine risk. I mean, I think it comes up a lot in discourse about physician assisted death, the same way, you know, in talking about socialized medicine, you know, Sarah Palin raised concerns about death panels. You know, people are going to tell you, well, tough, you're done. Your life isn't worth anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can certainly imagine it being a risk in a certain family for sure. Right. And in maybe many families, I just think that there are ways to build in protections against that. I mean, you know, you have to be conscious, you have to be, you know, of sound mind. So, you know, there are certainly ways to say to a person, do you really want this? And maybe someone's own consciousness would reflect internalizing feeling like a burden. I mean, I think that's a risk, right? But, you know, to make physician-assisted dying illegal in almost every state because of that seems like a massive overcorrection, right? Certainly, you know, there are other places we could study to see what are the kind of best practices. But, you know, I mean, I am watching a number of people I know getting older saying, I think we're gonna have to move to Oregon because, you know, it's like, I don't want to linger, you know, for days or weeks or months in a state where I have no control anymore. And I don't want to wait till, you know, I don't see death as something that has to take God's course for me. Right. I mean, if you do, because you have a religious framework about, you know, your existence, great. Then you should certainly not make this choice. But for people who don't, they want to have more control. And having said that, overselling the possibility of having control over your own death would be bad marketing, because really it can be unpredictable and messy and slow. You know, and maybe that's what a dying person's body needs. And it's maybe traumatic to their family members sitting around trying to support them, but not to them. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, it's still, you know, very mysterious to me. But I do think that that really to have to sort of wait for your body's, you know, disease and demise to play out on its own, because there's a risk that your family members will sell you out sooner so they can go to Disneyland. I don't know. that should inform the legal context.
Right. Yeah. So I'm just aware of the time here. I don't want to go too long. Wish we had time to talk about the PTSD chapter in detail. The one question I wanted to ask is, in part because it made its appearance in the newspaper this morning, about, you know, therapy now has been approved. I don't know if you saw it, but that, MDMA, the drug ecstasy, along with talk therapy, is now, I guess, apparently shown to be quite effective for treatment of PTSD. So I don't know if you want to comment on that or you know, other interventions that you might have in mind that kind of could flow from your view of relational informed autonomy.
Yeah, I mean, this was the context in the book that I knew the least about and was really, you know, just learning everything as I went. But I think, again, it's an example of like, you know, preference, just a general bias towards highly interventionist, short-term, cost-effective, insurance-covered, you know, therapies that, you know, many veterans now for a decade have been telling us they don't want to do that and it doesn't work. And so I think, you know, sometimes, you know, simpler is better. And I think that this is a challenge America's going to keep facing for a while, you know, decades, as this generation of soldiers from Afghanistan and the Middle East comes back to the US. And, you know, I think people should have all sorts of options available to them. Marijuana, if they want it, MDMA, if it's shown to work, right. But long-term supportive counseling with a trusted practitioner in a mutually vulnerable interdependent group setting, you know, has shown to be pretty effective. But it's expensive, and it admits essentially that the damage done may be permanent. And I think that that's the burden on us as a country to carry. And that if we really could admit it, it might filter back into some of the decisions we make about going to war. But again, it's like a context where in the mental health context, we've taken on what is essentially a highly interventionist, almost like surgical approach. But that's how we run our medical system today. Mm-hmm. That's the gold standard.
Good. Yeah. So I wanted to close by just asking two kind of more general questions. Maybe you could say conservative questions. We'll see what you think. So, I mean, the first question is about religion, because one of the things that struck me about your book is was the sort of conspicuous absence of religion in the context here. I mean, you talk about the Christian tradition of autonomy, mm-hmm. but one of the ways you might, I mean, at least one might think about religion and the role that it serves in people's lives is that it might serve a kind of solution, maybe is put in too strongly, but a way to address both the conceptual and the practical problems that, you know, religion might serve in a way to combine autonomy and humility, mm-hmm. conceptually, but it also provides a kind of practical framework, a form of community, that Gemeinschaft, right, in which people can make certain decisions. So, I was wondering what you thought about, you know, religious communities and the role, whether you know, sort of positively could contribute to your project or not.
You know, I think if people are members of religious communities, that's a great place for them to find that. I think we see increasingly in the United States people not being members of religious communities, and there not being new ways of finding that. So really, I'm not necessarily interested in bolstering the role of religion in these processes. I think it's plenty strong for the people who are religious. But I am really interested in thinking about how we can sort of re-spiritualize community in other ways outside of a religious framework. And so part of the way I've conceived of HIRA, of humility-informed relational autonomy, is a sort of spiritualization, maybe in a kind of a Nietzschean sense, right? A spiritualization of our lives in all their messy humanness and kind of the moving, you know, from a kind of a disciplinary context of what it means to be a good human to a much more almost like poetic one, right? That finds beauty and meaning in these moments and not so much a need to tame and manage them as the price of being, you know, sovereign individuals. So I think, you know, religion still performs a really important function for people who are religious. And I certainly, you know, sometimes envy those people. I am not religious and I don't, you know, miss being religious, though I grew up in a religious community that was important to my family at the time. But I do miss that sense of a moral community. And I, you know, have it in other dimensions of my life. I'm really lucky professionally to have colleagues who are like siblings and friends to me. And we have really a sense of mission. And that fulfills me in many ways. And I get to spend a lot of my days reading political theory and thinking about ethics. And that fulfills me in many ways. But I think in the healthcare context, right, I mean, I think religion still really functions in many ways, even for people who don't want it to, and, you know, and that to me is problematic. But that there are ways of building in human kind of spiritualized supports that are non-religious. And I think, you know, the left in the United States is confronting that many people desire some sort of spiritual dimension to the world, even though they don't want to be religious and may not believe in God. And that's an important thing that I think going back to our ethical traditions can help us find.
I think that's a really important point. I talked to Stephen White, you know, his Democratic Bearing book a while back, which makes an appearance there in your final chapter, which, you know, that makes very good sense to me in the sense that there is a, you know, there needs to be a kind of deep spiritual conception that sort of undergirds, you know, his understanding of a sort of radical openness to becoming, a kind of Nietzschean spiritualization that, you know, could provide a counterweight that, you know, that requires, I think, some institutional work. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'd be all for that.
We should require everyone to take political theory from eighth grade.
Here. The other question I had sort of went back a little bit in the conversation to the, you know, telling your kids to make the right choices, or make the right choice, which is, I kind of find myself saying that a lot to my kid. And I wonder if that's the right way of doing it. I mean, in part, the question is, I guess, this, which is, isn't there I'm thinking about the sort of liberal paradigm of choice and control that you're criticizing in this book. And I was wondering what, you know, case there might be to be made for that. And I was wondering if there's something that's a kind of like useful myth about that, you know, that view could be a kind of useful myth in some circumstances. And I was thinking in the childhood circumstance that instilling the idea that you have choice and control in the world to young kids is actually something that's useful. And that, you know, instilling the idea that like Fortuna rules the world might be disabling in some ways. So, I guess more broadly, I mean, the sort of way in which, you know, this, it may be an enabling myth for ambition, which is more broadly understood to have an outlet for ambitious individuals who can conceive of, you know, that I can do something with my life and right. so forth. I mean, this obviously has tremendous bad effects, but I wonder if there's a, you know, sort of trade-offs here that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are different stories we tell to kids at different ages, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't tell your four-year-old, like, do it, don't do it, it doesn't matter, we're all going into the abyss, right? I mean, your four-year-old might tell you that sometimes, but you probably don't tell your four-year-old that. So yeah, I mean, I think there is something, just like it's psychically comforting for kids to have delimited choices and get to make a choice. And I think psychologists have shown that for a long time, like too many choices is immobilizing and it leads to sort of confusion and depression, and no choices is, you know, too authoritarian. And so the question is sort of, what's the proper quote unquote choice architecture to present to a child, so they feel sort of this sense of agency and they learn to make choices and then fail and try again or whatever, right? So yes. So absolutely. I want my kids to think of themselves as people who can strive for autonomous agency and who can put information to use and who can kind of be strategic and capacious and they're thinking about these things. Fine. But, you know, as they get older, I also tell them things like, you know, you can do everything you want to try to control the outcome of this and you might not be able to. And it's, you know, and that's just sometimes how it goes. You can't make someone fall in love with you. You can't force an A on a test. I mean, you know, there's things that aren't going to go your way. And so I think there is something about teaching them to want to aspire to be autonomous, but also teaching them to embrace and work on and practice humility, because really we're all going to get kicked in the pants a lot in life. And we shouldn't feel ashamed of that. That's just the nature. I mean, we should feel ashamed of things we do wrong to other people and create harm. But, you know, merely not being able to live up to a certain ideal of autonomy isn't anything to be ashamed of. And if we have humility, often we can find humor and connections to others as we sort of flounder or face, you know, serious disappointment. And there's plenty of that. You know, this past year has given us all way more than we wanted. And you can rail against it, or you can take it into your soul in little bits and pieces and figure out how to, you know, how to laugh with others and then go on the best you can. I think, you know, my mom's advice to me growing up is still some of the best advice anyone's ever given me. It's like, life's not that grand. You just muddle through the best you can and try to laugh as much as possible. Okay, there you go. That's sort of the animating spirit of this book, I think.
Great. Yeah, well, and I've been taking copious notes because now I have some good parenting strategies as my 8-year-old emerges into the point, reveal these truths to her. Good, yeah.
Well, let me know how it goes.
I will, yeah. Well, Sarah, this has been a lot of fun. I really, really appreciate you, coming on and talking about your book. So thanks again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the invitation. And thank you to anyone who manages to listen all the way to the end and who reads the book. I appreciate any thoughts about it, and I'd love to engage with you on it now that it's an actual material thing in the world. So thank you so much, John.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.